VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. What happens when a top science journal publishes a research paper, especially one that could greatly benefit humankind, and it turns out to be a fraud or was born of scientific misconduct? Members of the scientific community have been expressing alarm over the increasing numbers of studies that had to be retracted by their publishers because of fraud, misconduct, or other reasons, such as questionable research. Today we discuss science research integrity with a science journal publisher, study authors, and representatives of the Office of Research Integrity at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. We have four guest segments on today's program. In our first segment, we're joined by Robert Howarth. He's a professor at Cornell University and is editor-in-chief of the science journal Limnology and Oceanography. Professor Howarth recently wrote an article in his science journal about some of the steps that can be used to fight science fraud. Professor Howarth, first of all, what is science fraud?
Well, you know, scientific fraud is when either a scientist or a group of scientists do something which runs counter to our culture and ethics. For instance, making up data as opposed to collecting it the real way, or misappropriating someone else's data, or republishing someone else's material. Those would all be examples. Failure to disclose financial conflicts of interest would be another example. Issues that I worry about as a journal editor have to do with scientific fraud in publication, which is, you know, universities and funding agencies have a broader range of worries.
How widespread is this problem?
Well, we don't entirely know, which is of concern. If we look at publication fraud, the number of papers which are published and then subsequently found to have some sort of a issue of fraud, usually fabricated data, the incidence of that being caught has gone up dramatically since the 1970s, particularly in biomedical fields. But whether that's a true increase in fraud or whether it's just that journal editors and staff are better at catching these things now is hard to say. I will point out, too, that it varies a lot from field to field. I publish an edited journal called Limnology and Oceanography, and we have a pretty low rate of fraud. We've actually never had a paper retracted, and perhaps out of 600 papers submitted every year, we might have 2 to 3 papers, which during the peer review system we catch as perhaps being problematic.
What kind of impact does this have on the scientific community?
Well, you know, science is built on trust and faith, fundamentally. So if you can't believe what your colleagues and peers have published, that's a problem. I will say, though, that part of the scientific process is to publish new material. Research scientists is always sort of at the frontier of what we know, obviously, and so you're pushing the envelope of understanding. That means that a fair amount of material that's published will not, in the long run, hold up, not because it's fraudulent, but simply because when other scientists try to repeat that experiment or look at the problem from another way, they'll realize that, oh, there was some sort of a problem with the logic or approach of the first paper. That's not fraud. That's the normal scientific process of checks and balances over time. So, you know, fraud adds into that. A fraudulent paper is likely to not have a lot of legs in the long run, but it's damaging to the process for sure, and you know, the entire scientific community, I think, is committed to trying to reduce fraud to the lowest level we possibly could.
Who bears the responsibility of policing against scientific fraud?
Well, a variety of people have some role there. So say the employer definitely has a responsibility. Those of us who work for universities, universities actively engaged in making sure that we hold up to ethical norms. Funding agencies bear a big responsibility, and they work with universities and other employers on that. And those of us who edit and publish the actual scientific journals have a responsibility to make sure that we're not publishing fraudulent material, or on the very rare occasion when that happens, that we take public actions to correct that and out the problem, if you will. So it's a shared responsibility. It's, of course, shared across the entire scientific community as well. This has received a lot of attention, particularly in the United States, over the last few months, because there have been a couple of very publicly noticeable papers retracted, one from Science, another paper published in Environmental Science and Technology had to have a correction published because the lead author had a major financial conflict of interest, which he did not disclose, which he should have. That's, I think, a case of fraud as well. So the New York Times picked up on this and wrote an article suggesting some ways forward for the scientific community. And I appreciated that they're drawing attention to the public of the problem of fraud, and we scientists need to do all we can. But the particular guidance of the New York Times I didn't think was very useful. They're basically telling us that we should do what we already do with journals. So I wrote a editorial in our journal, Limnology and Oceanography, suggesting some other ways we might work to reduce fraud. And part of that is simply talking about it in the scientific community, making sure that co-authors live up to their responsibilities. You know, most papers have multiple authors. Generally, when fraud occurs, it's the result of one author, either who's blind to an issue or just, you know, cutting corners because they're up against some deadline. That's wrong, of course, but you know, the co-authors have an obligation to make sure that doesn't happen, and I'm not sure co-authors across the board are taking that responsibility seriously enough yet.
Most of the journals, most of the papers I've seen are usually published in publications that offer peer review. Now, what kind of role does peer review play in preventing scientific fraud?
Peer review is a critical part of it. And yes, you're correct. Most of the papers that have been retracted are peer-reviewed journals. Generally, most fraud is caught before publication, and that's part of the role of peer review. You know, when we have a submission to our journal, we have an associate editor who's expert in that field. I work with them to identify expert reviewers. The expert reviewers work anonymously from the standpoint of the author and, you know, help the author, help us determine whether or not we should publish the paper. They also help the author improve their manuscript, but part of their role is to make sure that the information seems up to snuff, that there's enough information to evaluate and make sure that it's in fact not fraudulent or that it hasn't been published before. And as I say, for our journal, probably about twice a year, we will find through that peer review, out of 600 submissions, we'll find a case where the reviewers highlight a problem and we'll investigate further. We don't publish those papers, so in the 60 years of publication of our journal, we have never retracted a paper.
That was Robert Howarth, editor-in-chief of the science journal Limnology and Oceanography and a professor at Cornell University. Let's take a short break. We'll be back with our next program segment.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
We're back with the science edition of Press Conference USA. I am Rick Pantaleo. Today we're talking about science research integrity. In this segment, we are joined by Dr. Arturo Casadevall, MD. He's a professor and the chair of the Department of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, Johns Hopkins University. Back in 2012, Dr. Casadevall and two colleagues conducted a study where they found that misconduct accounted for the majority of retracted scientific publications. The study was published by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America. Dr. Casadevall, what is the difference between science fraud and research misconduct?
Well, let's just put it to say that fraud is within the realm of misconduct. It's a subset of it. Fraud is potentially the worst part of misconduct, although in which you make up data, although other parts of misconduct are very serious. Like, for example, ethical lapses would be just as serious as fraud.
Well, let's look at various aspects of this. Fabrication, how does fabrication play into science fraud and misconduct?
Fabrication will be outright fraud. And it's within misconduct.
And it's the same as falsification?
A falsification, it will be in the realm. These things are in a continuum. You know, there is no often sharp boundaries. But for falsification by itself is not necessarily a bad thing, if you think about it. Because if you falsify something that is known, that is, in fact, an advance. The problem is when you do falsification in the set of fraud. But I think I would keep the words separate.
Now, how prevalent is scientific misconduct and fraud?
You know, we don't know that. We like to think that it is not that prevalent. But there are no good numbers out there. And the concern, of which no one really has any good evidence for, is that it may be increasing because of all the pressures that have been brought on science.
That was one of the questions I was going to ask you next, is if you've noticed an increase or decrease in the incidence of fraud and misconduct.
So one of the indicators of misconduct is retractions. This is the study that I did with Ferrick Fang a few years ago. And what it appears to be is that the frequency of retractions has been increasing over the last several years. But I would caution that that doesn't necessarily mean that misconduct is going up, since there could be other reasons. For example, journals may be more likely to use the mechanism to correct the literature.
What would be the motivation for a scientist or researcher to commit science fraud or misconduct?
You know, I think the motivations are varied. I think that one of the concerns is that in a very competitive nature of science, that some individuals may be tempted to take a shortcut.
What about things like funding? Well, does that play a role?
Well, it may play a role indirectly, in the sense that in a tight funding environment, you by definition create a highly competitive environment. And in a highly competitive environment, some individuals may be more tempted.
Now, what would be the potential trouble or even physical danger of scientific fraud or misconduct?
I think that obviously, if it affects something in the public interest, it's very serious. Fraud or misconduct in a clinical trial that results in different conclusions is very troubling, because that could result in different medical recommendations. And you can imagine how people could be directly hurt by it.
I understand a little earlier this year, a researcher, I believe, I don't know if I had the university correct, but from the University of Iowa, was sent to jail for problems with scientific misconduct regarding research he had conducted or contributed to regarding an AIDS vaccine. Are you familiar with that?
I'm familiar only from the news sources. I don't have any inside information. But I think that the message in that case is that when fraud involves federal funds or government funds, that there is a possibility for very significant legal penalty.
Now, what about honest mistakes made in conducting research, or perhaps misreading the findings, or coming across errors made in creating the study document? Is this pretty common?
I think errors in science are very common. I think that the big difference between misconduct and error is intent. I think people make errors all the time, and, you know, in fact, errors are in the literature, and the good thing about science is that science is self-correcting. So when these are found, you know, the next paper basically fixes it and one goes forward.
That leads me to my next question, Doctor. I've noticed in reading research papers that they are very detailed, and a lot of care and effort seems to go into its preparation. How long, on average, would it take for a science team to create a study based on their research?
It's very open-ended. I think that at the very least, the best answer is several years. In my laboratory, everything we have done from the beginning of the work to having the manuscript published, you would say a good 3 to 5 years.
You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. Our topic is scientific research integrity. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA, or you can send us an old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. Dr. Cassidy-Duvall, before we broke away, we were talking about how long it would take a science team to create a study based on their research. Now, how much of this time is devoted to fact and error checking?
A lot of it. What happens is that the data doesn't all come at once. Mm-hmm. So what you often have is that the data appears, you look at it, you repeat the experiment, and you learn from it. And you don't really publish until you're confident that the material is reproducible.
Doctor, I'm curious, with the internet and other technology available, is it easier for someone to commit fraud or misconduct? And on the other hand, does today's technology make it easier to detect fraud?
I think the answer to your questions is yes to both.
Mm-hmm.
I think that today, when you can sit in your office and look at the entire literature, there is the potential for taking figures from papers and changing them and repackaging them and all that. On the other hand, the same technology allows many eyes to look at it. And there are, for example, new mechanisms of what is called post-peer review, in which the community can put comments online on papers. So let's say your paper is published, it is out there, it's in the internet. Many journals have comment sections,
mm-hmm.
and people could write, you know, I'm not sure what's going on with figure two.
And I have looked over some of these papers and specifically looked at the comments, and I noticed that some of these comments can be pretty harsh.
That's right. Well, you know, the scientific world deals with facts, and people can be tough, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, provided that it is civil.
Now, if you don't mind, Doctor, could we talk a little bit about the paper that you and your colleagues Ferrick Fang and Grant Steen conducted back in 2012? The paper
Yes.
was called Misconduct Accounts for the Majority of Retracted Scientific Publications. Well, that's a pretty alarming statement.
That is correct. Prior to us doing this study, if you had talked to most scientists, they would have said that error was likely to be the major cause of retractions.
Mm-hmm.
And to our surprise, we found that that was just not the case. And however, the misconduct ranged from minor things. I wouldn't say minor, because in scientific misconduct, there isn't anything as minor, but I would say different levels of misconduct. There was outright fraud, people synthesizing, fabricating data. In other places, there was plagiarism. In other places, there were problems with authorships and things like that, and that resulted in the paper being retracted. So that was a huge wake-up call, I think, to the community that there were some deep problems in the scientific literature.
Doctor, I really appreciate you taking time to join us today to talk about scientific fraud and misconduct. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Dr. Arturo Casadevall, MD, from the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University, Baltimore, Maryland. The Office of Research Integrity handles allegations of scientific misconduct that involves research that is supported with taxpayer funds by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. To get a look into what the office does concerning science research irregularities, we're now joined by Susan Garfinkel, who is Director of the Division of Investigative Oversight, and Zoe Hammett, the Director of Education and Integrity. Susan Garfinkel, first to you. Can you give us a bit of an overview on the Office of Research Integrity?
The Office of Research Integrity, or ORI, is made up of two divisions. One division handles the oversight of allegations of research misconduct, and the other division handles educational issues for the prevention of research misconduct.
Zoe, what prompted the creation of the office?
Well, in 1981, U.S. Representative Al Gore held congressional hearings in response to public disclosure of several high-profile cases that occurred at major research institutions within the country and addressed reports that cases were not being handled very well by the funding agencies or by the universities in which the misconduct occurred. So in 1985, Congress passed an act to require the Secretary of Health and Human Services to issue a regulation, which came out in 1989, and that was then changed in 2005. And the Office of Research Integrity was created in 1989 in two parts and then consolidated into its namesake now as ORI in May 1992.
Susan, I understand that your agency doesn't actually conduct the investigations, but sort of coordinates it?
Well, that's right. The investigations are handled by the institution or university where the research misconduct occurred. So if ORI gets an allegation, it refers the allegation, after assessing the merits of that allegation, to the institution where the misconduct occurred. The institution, if they receive public health service funds, has policies and procedures in place to deal with allegations of research misconduct. It's a multi-step process. ORI's role in that is that as the institution is progressing through their processes, ORI will provide guidance and will help institutions deal with the case in a way that's fair to all of the individuals who are involved. In addition, when the institution makes its final determination, the investigation report and all the documents are sent to ORI for ORI to review. That's when we go into our oversight mode. We review all the documents and make findings, if appropriate, for the federal government, the Department of Health and Human Services.
So of the investigations that go through the office each year, on average, how many of the investigations actually reveal science fraud or misconduct?
I would say in general, we have about 40 cases per year, roughly, that have gone through the whole process. And of those approximately 40 cases, we make findings of research misconduct in about 10 to 15 cases per year.
What happens to them if it's proven that scientific fraud or misconduct was found?
If scientific or research misconduct is found at the institutional level, the institution will follow its own procedures for dealing with that particular respondent. If it's a graduate student, they may be removed from the graduate school, depending on how serious the misconduct was. If it's a postdoc, their position might be eliminated. If it is a PI, there might be other actions that they'll take. They might terminate the person, or they might just put them under some kind of supervisory plan. They might ask them to go to training for responsible conduct in research so that they become better trained as a scientist and know not to do these kinds of things. But the institution process and findings is separate from ORI's findings. So when the case comes into ORI, ORI makes findings for the federal government to protect federal dollars. Depending on the scope and significance of the case, the findings in general are supervision of a research scientist, which means the institution that employs this scientist, if they receive PHS funds, will be put under a supervisory plan so their data and research will be monitored for a certain period of years. That's generally done with cases that are not as significant. If it's a very significant case of research misconduct, we will impose a debarment where the researcher will not be able to work or receive PHS funds. So if you take away NIH funding for a specific time period, it is very detrimental to a scientist's career.
Susan, Zoe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Susan Garfinkel and Zoe Hammett from the Office of Research Integrity at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Our final guest on today's program is Brian Nosek, a professor at the University of Virginia and the director and co-founder of the Center for Open Science. Professor Nosek recently coordinated the Reproducibility Project, Psychology. This research project sought to replicate the findings of 100 research papers that had been published in 3 prominent psychology journals. While Professor Nosek's project wasn't specifically aimed at finding scientific fraud or misconduct, it turned out that his team of researchers could only duplicate less than one half of the 100 original findings. The researchers explained that in some cases where the papers couldn't be totally replicated, it might cause some to wonder about the validity of those original scientific findings. But, on the other hand, failure to duplicate a study's findings could have also been due to difficulty the researchers may have had in conducting effective replications and achieving reproducible results. Professor Nosek, can you give us a bit of an overview of your project?
Yeah, the goal of the project was to try to figure out how much of the published literature in psychology can be reproduced. being reproducible is sort of a core piece of evidence in science, a core feature of science, where a particular claim, a particular finding, presumably could be conducted independently by a different group and obtain the same evidence. That sort of is what gives it credibility. But we don't know the extent to which findings in the published literature are reproducible, even though it's an important assumption. And there's reasons to expect that it may not be as high as we would like it to be. And those reasons include things like, it's not in my interest as a practicing scientist to guarantee that the results that I publish are reproducible. What's in my interest is to get them published. And the kinds of things that allow it to get published aren't necessarily the things that make the research that we do reproducible. So the project was an effort to try to generate an initial estimate of reproducibility.
I'm assuming, Professor, that being able to replicate, reproduce a previously conducted study sort of adds some validity to it?
It does in the dimension of confidence that there is an effect there. It could be that the interpretation is wrong, right? We may be able to reproduce a finding again and again and still completely misunderstand why it is occurring. But it is still an important element of gaining confidence that the effect is there, that there is something to observe. And then the next step is to debate about what it means, and that requires additional research.
How big of a problem is reproducibility, and why is it a concern?
It's a concern because if the work that we're doing is not reproducible, then it's very difficult for it to become cumulative. It's difficult for us to do additional studies and learn new things if all of the findings that we have aren't actually ones that can be reproduced. Because science is an incremental process in the sense that no one study is definitive evidence about anything. Science progresses by reducing uncertainty. So each study adds something, accumulates to making an understanding of what it all means. And so each one, we presume, has some degree of reproducibility. And so it's vitally important that we understand it. And it isn't the case that everything is going to be reproducible, right? We're working on problems that are hard. We're going in directions that we don't understand. We're studying things that we don't understand because we don't understand them. That's why we study them. So we're going to have lots of false starts. There will be intriguing initial evidence that ends up being irreproducible later. But if it's pervasively irreproducible, then we're going to be very efficient in our knowledge building. And so we want to maximize that efficiency.
Tell us about your team of researchers. I understand they're from all over the world.
Yeah, this is a challenging question to test because how do you actually estimate the reproducibility of a whole literature? And of course, we didn't try to reproduce the whole literature, but we did try to get a sizable sample. So 100 original studies, we tried to reproduce their original research. But no one lab could possibly do that, particularly because doing replications like this aren't rewarded in science very strongly. So we did it as a crowdsourcing effort. A small team put together the design of the project and then invited people from the community in psychology to get involved and conduct replications. And we wound up with 270 co-authors from something like 25 or 30 different countries. Another 80 or so people that helped with producing the evidence that we report in the article.
After reviewing the research conducted by this massive team, were there any indications of scientific fraud or misconduct?
So none in the research that we did any replications of. There was one article that was in our sample that ended up getting removed from our sample because separate from our project, there was fraud and the article was retracted. This is one of the infamous Diedrich Stoppel papers who was famously a few years ago identified as having produced fraud in 50 or more papers in psychology. So we didn't do a replication of that because it was identified as fraudulent. But all of the research that we did, there's no reason to suspect that anything in it is fraudulent per se.
Professor, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk about this and your project and the results of your project. We do appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Thanks for the good questions.
That was Brian Nosek, co-founder of the Center for Open Science and a professor at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. And that's all the time we have on this week's Science Edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank the people who helped engineer this program: Evan Nanechka, Nick Ivanov, Nashwan Kole, and Bob Doty. The Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Join us again next week for Press Conference USA with Carol Castillo on the Voice of America.